This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar. Today we're in Mound.
Where are we, Lionel?
We're at Mound. This is the airfield, I think, is it? This is the airfield? Yeah, we're at the top of the hill, over the top of the hill, at Mound Airfield.
And the big,
been very hot again here today.
In big plateau, it's a big plateau just at the climb. If anyone's seen the stage, the riders climb the very steep, vicious 3 kilometre long climb, sweep round onto the airfield and come around. And we've just witnessed Steve Cummings win the stage for MTN Quebec. I should say that my name is Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Daniel Freeb.
Hello.
And it's been another arduous day, another hot day. Riders suffering and some of the journalists suffering too, aren't they, Daniel?
Yeah, it's been a tricky day. It's been a bit of a defiance in the car today, wasn't there? Got a bit of heat exhaustion, and it's ongoing. This is a developing situation because the temperature has just gone up again, and I'm starting to feel a little bit woozy again.
We're ready to catch you if you fall. Roman Bardet, of course, suffered heat exhaustion the other day and bounced back, and he was on the attack today. But so, Daniel, you might be bouncing back tomorrow. It's quite ironic, though, because when we came out of the car at the start this morning, baking heat, Lionel and I were applying our Factor 50 sun cream, as we do every morning, and you were mocking us. You were mocking us and being really smug and superior with your sort of Mediterranean olive complexion. But I have to say, half an hour or so later, the last laugh was on us, wasn't it, Lionel? Not that we were laughing.
No, we certainly weren't. We're very sympathetic to Daniel's needs. I brought back a lot of water and soft drinks, you know. Excellent. Daniel needs...
I won't forget that.
No, we need to replace lost sugars. So I think a revitalising can of cola drink, revived him for a bit. But as you say, it's not the big news story of the tour today, to be honest. But yeah, he's coming down a bit again.
God, he's declining before our eyes. Okay, this stage. Roman Bardet, well, there's several talking points today, and we're going to get on to one of the main ones, if not the main one, which was Chris Froome's allegation that a spectator threw urine at him. We'll be hearing in a moment from Chris Froome and from the stage winner, Steve Cummings, as well as Brian Smith. Steve Cummings, general manager at MTN Quebec. But talk us through the last few kilometres of the stage, Daniel. Or don't talk us through, I'll talk us through. Roman Bardet attacked near the bottom of the climb. Young British rider Sammy Yates went with him. I thought he was riding very intelligently, but he was obviously digging very deep, and he blew up. Thibaut Pinot, meanwhile, launched a counterattack, got up to Roman Bardet. But Steve Cummings just rode a very intelligent race as well. Rode up at his own pace. He's not as good a climber as those guys, he knows that, but he caught them over the top and beat them. And was it a Cummings victory or a French cock-up?
I think a bit of both. I mean, not so much a cock-up, but they just didn't have the legs, did they, Bardet and Pinot? Cummings did say in his post-race press conference that he wasn't entirely sure what the AG Tour plan was, because they had another rider in that break, Jan Bakelants, and their tactics, in his view, didn't make a whole lot of sense.
They don't get on, though, do they, Bardet and Pinot? Is there not a bit of needle between them?
No, I think they get on okay. I mean, there's obviously going to be some rivalry because they've both been hyped up as the next French stage race sensation, and they've not had a particularly good tour, neither of them. I was on French radio last night. Richard Veronque, everyone remembers, and you know, still has a warm place in their heart for Richard Veronque, I'm sure. I got into a bit of a spat with him about the French riders, and I suggested that they haven't reached the level of maturity yet where they can be absolutely reliable year after year. You can't expect them to have the same tour that they had last year every year. They're just not at that point in their career yet, and they're still figuring things out. You know, Pinot, for instance, in this tour has had a big problem with the heat. And you know, generally in July it's quite hot, so if he's got a big problem with the heat, he's going to have to figure that out. He's a bit like me, you know. I'm going to have to go away, analyse what's happened on this tour, and come back with a different strategy. But
get the data.
Yeah, well, exactly. At least it was good to see signs of life from the French, and I'm sure those two, in particular Bardet and Pinot, will ride very well in the Alps.
Talking of strategy, we stood in the shade of a large vehicle in a bid to protect Daniel. It's now reversed away, leaving us exposed to the sun. Let's find another spot, chaps. Okay, we're back behind another vehicle. Steve Cummings, Lionel, you know him well. He came through the British system but left Team Sky at the end of 2011, I think it was, to join BMC. And he's always been a strong rider, but he seems to be having a very good season. And, you know, I was saying to somebody earlier, he's probably one of 30, 40, 50 riders who you could pick out on the start sheet of the Tour who could possibly win a stage if all this, the planets aligned. And they aligned for him today, didn't they?
Well, they did, yeah. I mean, it made me feel a little bit old because I remember covering the 1999 British Junior Road Race Championship somewhere in the Midlands, which Steve Cummings won. And then, you know, he got taken into the British cycling system. I think later that year he rode the time trial in the World Championships. And if I'm not mistaken, I remember following in the team car, if I'm not mistaken, Fabian Cancellara overtook him, caught him for maybe 2-3 minutes in that time trial in Verona. But yeah, he was part of the tracks squad for a long time, won a silver medal at the Olympics in 2004 in the team pursuit, but never seemed to be sort of, he never seemed to quite fit in on the track. He's a track rider. He's very good at the team pursuit, and he's done well in individual pursuits as well. But one of those riders that kind of falls between two stools. He's got a lot of talent, but he hasn't necessarily had all of the opportunities to use that talent. And I think he didn't necessarily fit so well into the Team Sky system, and a lot happier out of that and in BMC. And I think now in MTN Quebec, he's found a team where he made the point in the press conference there that he knows he's going to get opportunities and they trust him to take opportunities or make the best of the opportunities. And that is exactly what he did today. I mean, he got into that break and then he rode incredibly smartly all afternoon. You almost didn't notice that he was in there. He wasn't as visible. He was quite often at the back, you know.
This is the first podcast we've even mentioned him in, which is almost unbelievable, but he's been invisible. Yeah. Daniel, were you going
to... No, Lionel mentioned his time at Team Sky. He was the least suitable rider for Team Sky because he's a free hitter, he's a sort of number 10, you call me the number 10 of the podcast team, the sort of fancy Dan who minces about not doing a whole...
yellow boots on.
Yeah, exactly.
Pink jeans.
And he's also actually, he belongs to that category of riders I call the minceurs, who spend a lot of time at the back of the peloton. So there's Thomas Vogler's always there, Ryder Heijerdahl, Joaquin Rodriguez, Thibaut Pinot, they love it at the back of the peloton, not having too much stress. So the worst thing you could do to Steve Cummings is tell him he has to ride on the front all day, and he just likes lurking, and his whole strategy in this Tour de France has been to lurk and mince for 2 weeks, and he was always going to target these stages. Sorry, Richard, go!
I think as well that he is prone to his head going down a bit. He can become a little bit negative. There was this famous story in 2010 where it was all going wrong for Team Sky, but they were being encouraged, told to attack every day, and it just nothing was happening for them. And you had two contrasting characters in the very upbeat, sunny, permanently aggressive Juan Antonio Fletcher, and Steve Cummings, who by the third week really had given up. And there's a story of him going to the loo in the Team Sky bus and coming back and finding a post-it note on his chair from Juan Antonio Fletcher, which read, "You will leave your balls on the mountain or you will not get back on this bus." So anyway, let's hear...
I think the significance of the day as well for MTN Quebec, it's Mandela Day. They had an inspirational kind of team talk this morning. It was important to them on so many levels. And I think as one of the wildcard teams, you know, they've absolutely... Well, they'd already justified their presence in the race with Daniel Tecklaheimer not in the King of the Mountain jersey for so long. But, I mean, this really is the icing sugar on the cherry on the cake, really.
Let's hear from Steve Cummings and then from Brian Smith, his general manager at MTN Quebec. Tour de France stage winner.
Pretty good, yeah. It's been something I've been trying to work on for a while, but it's not easy to get the opportunity, so I have to really thank the team for bringing me here and giving me the chance and giving me like a sort of free roll in the first week to just get through and wait for these stages, these kind of 4 or 5 stages now, which we were targeting, which were good for me. So you grow up and it's a dream, I think, the Tour de France, especially these stages for me. And if I was ever going to win a stage, it was going to be from a breakaway like that. So happy guy when I retire now, I think.
Steve, can you just tell us how you rode the climb? There were a lot of attacks, guys going off. Did you know the way you were going to ride that climb? Because it's a very steep, very tough climb. What was your sort of strategy going up there?
Yeah, I knew. I did the climb before in Paris-Nice in, I think, 2010, and I knew it was really quite tough. I knew roughly it was around 10 minutes probably. And my strategy was basically go as fast as I could go and ignore the attacks, really. And it worked out really well. That was the best strategy. I didn't really think I could win, to be honest, because they're a lot better climbers than me, but maybe I just played it better than they played it. So we had a special meeting on the bus today. We had special helmets. You know, it's a huge day in South Africa, and it was extra motivation. We were G'd to get in the break, and tried a lot. Almost never happened, and then yeah, it's great. We're gonna have a party tonight, I think.
You've been in some big teams, Steve. What's it like being part of this team?
Oh, I'm really enjoying it, really relishing it. I mean, it's strange, like people say big teams, but I honestly think that what we do in our team here is just as good as any team. We have a different strategy. We want to be aggressive, and we're racing for stages, so it kind of suits me really well, because I can take it easy and stay out of the way on the days that aren't so good, and then the days that are good for me, I can really sort of try and get stuck in. I mean, it doesn't always work, but when it does, it's really nice.
It was never in doubt, really, was it?
No, it wasn't. 1 in 20. Oh, this was one of the stages we planned for him. And, you know, the guys are tired after yesterday. Even Ed Vald and these guys, they've tried in the first, you know, half of this tour. And, you know, now we were starting to see some of the guys starting to feel tired, especially yesterday. It was such a hard day. We rode for Ed Vald. He struggled a bit in the final. But today was always keep Steve calm, keep him calm, and when he gets in a breakaway, and I asked Ed Vald earlier on, make sure he gets in that breakaway. He did, he tried twice, he got in the breakaway, 1 in 20. Most teams would be on, you know, wouldn't think that would be great, especially with 3 AG2R, 3 Francais de Joux and 2 AG2R. Then you look at the names, Horan, Bardet, Pinot, even Simon Yates, you think, this finish. And I was getting in, you know, he came back to the car. I was behind the peloton. He came back to the car and says, you know, what do I do? And when I seen the way the race was going, I said, look, just be patient. Just be really, really patient. It's going to be who's got the strongest legs in the final climb. He's a perfectionist. You know, he's an artist when it comes to these things. He knows I don't have to encourage him. We just let him race in the last 25Ks. He's not the sort of rider that you say, come on, Steve, you can do it. You know, everybody else is looking weaker. Come on. Just leave him to it, and he'll deliver. And that's what we did. And I says to him, I said, look, over the top of the climb, Bardet and Pinot started looking at each other. He went straight to the front. And I know he's one of the most aero people on the bike. When he gets in front, even 2 metres in front, there's no way they were coming back. And, you know, what a magnificent day, especially on Mandela Day.
Yeah, I was about to say, I mean, it's not an African rider that won, but obviously you're an African team, the first African team, proper African team, to ride the Tour de France. How much does that mean to you and some of the other guys in the team?
It's huge. It's absolutely huge. When some of the guys, especially the African guys, they've really fought. Serge, even the Belgian, who's 24th at the start of today, they've really fought in this tour and delivered. You know, we came here with a stage win in mind, to have a leader's jersey and to be prominent, to come here and race. And I think we've done that already. And today, of all days, if I could wish for, you know, a stage win, it would have been this stage from any of the riders. You know, Steve's no different from everybody else. And, you know, just wanted to be in the race, but we could see we were missing things. There was a lot of tired legs. And in the last 2 days, I've never seen a peloton like it. They're coming out in ones and twos the whole time. And there's a lot of tired legs, and we've been holding Steve back for this, and, you know, it's just top today off.
You told me earlier in the tour that it has been all about patience with Steve, hasn't it? He almost wrote off the first week or first 10 days. He knew this was his period of the tour, didn't he?
Of course he did. When everybody, Steve can go fast, but I'm not going to say he's a diesel, he's more than a diesel, because once the pace settles, we're deep into the Tour de France now, once the pace settles, he comes into his own. And you look at when he won the stage of the Vuelta, gets himself in a breakaway, he comes into his own. Whenever, you know, in the first week, when everybody's nervous, crashes, he's just sat at the back, and everybody says, why is he sitting at the back? You know, get him in the breakaway today. I don't even care. I said in this morning's meeting, I don't care if it's 10, 15 riders. We get Steve in there, we'll get a chance. And he delivered. But the thing is with Steve, you can't pressurise him, you can't push him. He knows what he's doing. He just needs reassurance sometimes. And for this team to win in Mandela Day, you know, the orange helmets were out there all, but they, to even, this was a boost. If he'd come away with a place, we've had a fourth place, fifth places, you know, you name it, we've been in the top 10. But to get a win here, it's just raised, you know, the confidence in the team now. And hopefully we'll get through tomorrow into the rest day, and then we've got plans for the rest of the tour. We're not finished yet.
Follow us on Twitter at cycling_podcast or on our website, thecyclingpodcast.com.
So we heard there from Steve Cummings and Brian Smith, both absolutely jubilant and happy. Somebody less jubilant and happy was Chris Froome at the finish, who managed to not lose any time to Nairo Quintana, who looked strong and active on the climb up to Mond. I think Quintana's looking better and better. You know, it's a small climb. It's perhaps not the perfect one for Quintana. He'll prefer the longer sort of passes in the Alps. But the omens are looking better, I think, for the tour.
Yeah, I spoke to his director sportif at the finish, José Luis Arrieta, who confirmed this is very much their strategy to wait for the third week. And he pointed out that Quintana has always gone better in the third week than the two previous weeks in Grand Tours. But having said that, they acknowledge that Chris Froome has to regress, or else the pecking order is going to stay as it is, because Froome has been stronger than Quintana up until now.
Not only did he not lose time, Chris Froome, he actually gained 1 second on Nairo Quintana on the final climb. The question is, Froome has made more of these efforts over the course of the race so far. We're now 2 weeks in. Quintana has chosen his moments much more sparingly, and as Daniel says, if the plan is to come on strong in the final week, you just never know. Froome is, you know, he's going through the whole thing of leading the Tour de France. He's in the yellow jersey, he's got that spotlight on him all the time, he has to come and do the press every day. All of that adds up, and the cumulative factor of being the stress of being the Tour de France leader, you know, that maybe will offer a chink of hope for Quintana.
Right, well, listen, we also learned at the finish of a very unsavoury incident out on the road. Chris Froome, I spoke to him in the mix zone after the race. We'll hear that interview in a moment. It follows our interview last night with Richie Port, who I'd heard had been punched and obviously had an altercation with some spectators who accused him of being a doper as well. He gave us a very emotional interview where he confirmed that those events had happened. He was very unhappy about it, and just also about the general level of abuse that's being aimed at Team Sky. We've played the interview without any comment. It goes without saying, really, that it's absolutely abhorrent. It's an awful thing that's happening. Chris Froome made the point in his press conference that he blames irresponsible reporting, and I have to say that I think he has a point. We spoke about this the other day. It's not, you know, calling all journalists irresponsible would be like calling all cyclists dopers. That would be unfair. But I think there has been some irresponsible reporting. I'm talking about reporting based not on facts but on opinions, or opinions that are not founded in any facts. I mentioned Pierre Ballester the other day. I mentioned him again. I think that the interview he gave for Libération on a subject about which he doesn't know a great deal, he doesn't know a great deal about Chris Froome, he doesn't know a great deal about Team Sky, was disgraceful. And there are others as well. So to recap, or to cap, the alleged incident today on the stage, on the road. Oh, there goes President Hollande. Oh no, it's Team Sky. It's Chris Froome actually being given a police escort off the mountain. That's not that unusual. But you know, there has definitely been a bigger police presence around the team. There was a police officer at the entrance to the bus this morning, and they're getting greater security. But yeah, Froome at the end of the stage said that a spectator had poured urine on him. Now, that allegation has been made before, and it's sometimes difficult to know whether it's true or not. In this case, he says that he saw the spectator peeing into a cup and throwing it over him and shouting dope at him. And so he was obviously upset by this, and this is what he had to say after the stage.
A great day for us on the road in terms of the racing. Team did a fantastic job again, brought me to the foot of the last climb in pole position. But as you said, yeah, it was unfortunate what happened out on the road there. A fan throwing urine at me and shouting dope at me while he did it. That's disgraceful. There's no other way to put it. It's certainly not in the name of sport, and it's a shame that a few individuals can ruin it for everyone else.
Is it affecting you, Chris? I mean, we spoke to Richie, who obviously had some rough treatment the other day as well. Is it affecting you, and is it affecting the team?
I think it's actually pulling us together as a unit even stronger. I mean, it feels as if we're under siege a little bit. And as I said, though, it's the minority of people doing it. Richie got punched the other day. It's not on. And of course, from my point of view, I don't blame the public. I blame some of the irresponsible reporting that's been around the race. Obviously, that's where this whole notion of Team Sky is doping, you're doping, has come from, and it's not on. We work extremely hard to do what we do, and it's got absolutely nothing to do with doping.
How about the climb, Chris? I mean, Quintana got little gaps, you brought him back. Was that a painful effort, and do you think he's looking a little bit stronger?
I was riding very much within myself there. I knew how steep the climb was, I knew it was short. I knew he wasn't going to get too far away from me if I just rode my own steady tempo up there, and my goal was just to get him back before the top of the climb, have a bit of a free ride to the line with him trying to take more time from the other contenders. So we're really into the guts of the race at this point.
You are listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar, with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Froome.
So we heard there from a very upset Chris Froome. Lionel.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about the Tour de France and with the big crowds and road cycling in general is there's this incredibly fragile pact between the riders and the spectators. And in the main, you know, on unbarriered bits of road, the requirement for the supporters, the spectators, is that they do not lay a hand on the riders. And in the past, we've seen people trying to give a helpful push on a rider's backside. We've in the past seen riders being handed bottles that, you know, bottles of water that riders back in the day used to take and drink or pour over their heads. That all stopped. Well, they certainly stopped drinking it because of the possible risk of...
Although, Lionel, I saw the other day Leopold Koenig took a bottle of water from a spectator on the mountain and drank it, which I was quite surprised by.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen, I haven't been looking out for it, but it's not something you see as regularly now because they might have a spiked water bottle. Somebody might put some amphetamines or something in a bottle and hand it to a rider. I mean, you know, that's outlandish and a bit conspiracy theorist, but this relationship between the spectators and the riders is what the Tour de France hinges on, and if that is going to break down, which in the last few days there's a danger, and particularly with Chris Froome, he's in a very difficult position because he wants to speak out. They want to speak out and tell people what is the treatment that they're being met with out on the road. It's unacceptable. Even in, you know, very rare cases, it's unacceptable. We've now had a couple of things in as many days. Some people will think it's all part of a grander conspiracy and will question whether or not there was really urine in the cup and maybe it was warm water or whatever. You know, some people will even maybe question whether Richie Port got punched. We can only take the riders at their word on this. But there is definitely a groundswell of unpleasant... you know, atmosphere around the race, and if riders are coming in and saying this is the kind of stuff that's happening to them out on the road, the real bind that Chris Froome's in is that he wants to say something, he wants to draw it all to a halt, but by saying what he said in the press conference this evening and sort of fanning the flames of it, there is also the risk that it just multiplies the behaviour and people think, oh well, if that's going on, you know, not... It's a tiny minority, but it only takes one person to punch a rider and knock them off, and that's a huge incident, and then it changes the dynamic between the people on the roadside, who in almost all cases are fantastic and are there to watch the sport, and the riders who will rightly start to fear for their safety, and they will call for every climb to be barriered from bottom to top, and they will, you know, have even more security. So I think the Tour is on a... I don't want to over-sensationalise this, but the Tour is on a little bit of fragile point at the moment.
Punch or worse, you know, let's imagine, you know, there are all sorts of possibilities of worse scenarios. I mean, the most famous previous incident of this was 1975 on the Puy de Dôme, where Eddy Merckx was punched by a spectator, and I spoke to Lucien Van Impe about that incident. He won that stage, and he said that at that time there was an awful lot of anti-Merckx feeling in France, that the French, he said, were very can't remember the word he used, prejudiced against Merckx in particular and the Belgians in general, and that having stones thrown at them was routine. That was the only case he could remember of a rider being punched, but having stones thrown at them was apparently routine. So perhaps it's not the entirely new thing that we imagine, but of course the possibilities for awful things to happen are there, the amazing thing, considering that 15 million people are said to watch the Tour by the roadside, is it doesn't happen more often. And that is, I think, because, as you say, Lionel, the vast majority of people come out to watch races. I stood on Plata de Bay in 2004, and there was quite a lot of hostility there towards US Postal. It was all taken out on the team cars as they went up the mountain before the race. There was a lot of banging on the roof and so on. But as soon as the riders appeared, people parted, and there was an automatic respect there. Daniel, you're back.
Yes. How much have I missed?
What you missed? Chris Froome telling us about having a cup of urine thrown at him.
Well, there were incidents involving Team Sky before, weren't there? On Le Semnoz's last mountain stage of the 2013 Tour, I think Rod... On Semnoz, Rod Ellingworth, who's the race coach at Team Sky, I think his car... Well, he was not apprehended, but he certainly heard some heckling out the window, and I think he stopped the car and had a little bit of a lively exchange with a French fan. I mean, I don't think the problem is necessarily the proximity of the crowds to the riders. I don't think there's anything you can realistically do about that, neither should we really want to do anything about that, because it's what makes cycling unique. I think that the real problem here is the poisonous atmosphere that is developing around Team Sky and around the race in general, and you know, a lot of sympathy for Team Sky, certainly, because they've really tried to do a lot of things, and they have not been able to silence this ill feeling, and they've not really been able to put any kind of lid on it. And you know, people will say, well, that's because it continues, because A, the image of the Tour de France and the atmosphere around the Tour de France has been poisoned by the last 10 years, the last 15 years, or last 100 years of doping. And it's just something that we have to wait out. We just have to accept this, not get too crazy about it, and not being too impulsive in the way we react to it. And people will also suggest that they are getting this much scrutiny because their performances are, by per se, suspicious.
I totally agree that there shouldn't be an overreaction. It's a bit like the threat of terrorism, isn't it? Yeah. The overreaction almost makes the problem worse. And you know, far better to carry on as normal and trust to the wisdom or decency of the crowd.
Yeah, which is why, you know, Chris Froome's sort of statement in the press conference, it's dangerous in that sense, as I just said, because you don't know. There's a lot of journalists in there from a lot of different media. And will everyone treat that? It's the same as the power numbers and all of the speculation. Not everyone will treat this as responsibly as perhaps they should. And so if it gets fanned up in certain segments of the media, then certain segments of the fans see that as and the whole thing snowballs.
I think it was an extremely dangerous statement to make. I totally understand why he made it. He's obviously absolutely furious, and we all would be furious in that situation. But I suppose this is where someone has to step in from Team Sky and say, Chris, unfortunately, you have to keep a lid on that.
I mean, I felt with Richie Porte telling us what had happened as well, that by getting it out there, that overwhelming majority of decent people who come to watch a bike race, come to watch the best bike race in the world, it's a bit like the problem of racism in football. When that became stigmatised, there's a sort of element of self-policing in the crowd. And if that, you know, the vast majority of people in Alpe d'Huez, for example, will be there to watch the bike race, and they would be absolutely appalled by the very idea of you know, assaulting riders, even abusing them. And I think if that minority, if other people who are there can be aware that there's that minority, they can help to stamp it out.
And obviously, although Chris Froome said he recognised the gentleman who had thrown the...
Gentleman?
Well, the individual.
The thug.
Individual who had thrown the urine at him. I think it'd be pretty difficult for Chris Froome to track him down. But as you say, Rich, there is... There can be an element of self-policing, and all it takes is for, you know, if you're in a crowd and you see someone doing something like that, then you alert the police. There are plenty of police around the Tour de France, and that really is a solution to the problem, isn't it?
You put them in a headlock. Interesting, that Merckx incident in 1975, Merckx did identify the culprit. Nello Breton was his name. He went back down the mountain with the police and identified him, and he was charged with an offence, and Merckx went and attended the hearing. Daniel knows this because he wrote the cannibal... He was awarded one franc in damages, and I've been working on a series of articles based on this for Bicycling magazine in the US, so I've been doing a little bit of research into this. It feels like a sort of bad bit of timing in a way, almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy to be writing about this, talking about this, and lo and behold, it's happened.
And now, le pédaleur de charme, supported by British Eurosport.
Okay, on a lighter note, the British Eurosport Pedaleur de Charme award. Now, there are a few nominations today. It's a lot for Steve Cummings, but he won the stage. I think he's been rewarded enough.
What?
You know, the winner is Mark Cavendish, who was nominated for... There was a moment, and he was at the back of the bunch, and Richie Porte had been fetching bottles, and he was on his way back, and he was kind of struggling to move up the line. And Cam just dropped back a little bit and gave him a little push back up to the bunch.
Wow. Who's presenting him with that, then?
This is the moment you've been waiting for, Daniel. It's going to be your job to present Mark with his Pedaleur de Charme t-shirt. Don't let us down.
I think he'll stop short of drenching me with urine, but the reaction is often fairly spicy, isn't it?
I think he'd be quite pleased.
I think he'd be fine.
I think he'll be happy.
I think he'd be delighted. I think he'd be thrilled.
Not a lot else for him in the tour at this point.
See how fickle I am. My feeling on this has just swung.
Might he win tomorrow?
180 degrees in 10 seconds. Could he win tomorrow? Yes, he could. This is last chance before Paris.
So we're not going to the start tomorrow, so it'll be your job. I mean, you might have to go up, if he wins the stage, you might have to go up on the podium, Daniel, and present him with it on the podium. We'll see. We'll ask Christian Prudhomme about that.
I'm seeing Prudy tomorrow morning.
Yeah, for a kilometre zero upcoming. Will they start again on Monday? Yeah. Listen, don't have a conversation.
Sorry, no. Yeah, we need to talk about that, whether he's seeing Prudy tomorrow. Yeah. So, a couple of things. We don't yet know the full ins and outs of Eduardo Sepulveda's exclusion from the tour. We perhaps ought to find out and then insert a little bit. That we're waiting for the communique from the race jury on that to confirm. But I did have my heart skipped a beat a little bit when some sanctions were handed out for vehicles following the tour. Press band 1179, which is a press vehicle, has been excluded from the tour for stages 13 and 14. And I had a horrible moment. We're not 1179, are we? But because this morning, coming out of Rodez, I was sitting in the passenger seat of our right-hand drive English Jaguar with my laptop open, my phone in my hand, and one foot up on the dashboard, and a gendarme absolutely furious...
On a motorbike.
On a motorbike. A gendarme came past... absolutely furious. His face couldn't have been angrier, and he was pointing and pointing and telling me to put down the telephone portable, and my hands were in the air, and it must have looked to him for a moment like I'd then just taken both hands off the steering wheel and was mocking him and driving along with my knee.
You then put the window down and started waving both hands out the window.
Yeah. And I wasn't getting my message across terribly effectively, but fortunately he recognised that we were in a right-hand drive car, that I wasn't driving whilst typing on the laptop and using a mobile phone.
Luckily he didn't see my laptop, eh?
It's a horrible predicament to be in when you get red-carded. We've been red-carded before, haven't we, Rich?
But we haven't been red-carded.
We were red-carded, but they forgot to suspend us to give us our automatic one-stage suspension.
Well, that was 2010, wasn't it? Maybe tell that story another time.
So we'll come back with a...
The policeman did then apologise. He gave a big smile and he apologised.
He did, yeah. That was, so, gendarme de charme today. I don't know who he was or where he's from, but thank you for that. But we ought to find out what happened to Sepulveda. The rumour is that he had broken his chain and he was unable to locate his team car. And so he got into the AG2R, a rival team's team car. He got into the AG2R team car and got a 100-metre lift up to his Bretagne Sechet
car. Car doping.
Very naive, isn't it, thinking that you can do the Tour de France in a car? I mean, I know it's from Argentina and we don't get many professional cyclists from there, but that is...
mentioned one of them earlier, Fletcher.
That is unforgivable.
Well, I mean...
It's retro doping, isn't it? I mean, they used to jump on trains and things like that and get in cars.
You know, when you've got Eugene Christophe fixing his forks with... bellows and in a forge on halfway up the Tourmalet at the bottom of the Tourmalet. I mean, you know, surely he could have contrived a way to go 100 metres up the road to where his team car was.
Yeah. Anyway, we should leave it there, chaps. Let's say goodnight and head off to our hotel. And we'll be back tomorrow. Kilometre Zero starts again on Monday. So thanks again for listening, and thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.
For the best analysis, discussions and interviews from the 2015 Tour de France, listen to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.